begin with our motivation. So again, tuning into the fact that we are not isolated, inherently existent individuals who are interrelated with other living beings and the rest of the world. Because that's completely contradictory. We have to be dependently arising people who exist interdependently with other living beings and with the environment. And dependent arising means that there's no core essence. There's no findable person who we are when we search for exactly who we are. Can't find anything. And yet there's this dependently arising appearance that of a person that functions, that changes every moment, that it has no essence. And so because we are dependent arisings, there's the possibility to generate wisdom and overcome our ignorance. There's the possibility to change from a samsaric state to an awakened state. And so realizing that, like all other beings, we and others are bound by our ignorance and cyclic existence. Let's have the compassion that wants all of us to be free from this, and therefore practices the path to attain full awakening. Night I could almost hear the gasp in the room when I said there's just a body and mind there. What are you talking about? There's just a body and mind. That sounds so robot-like, so impersonal, so, you know, staccato. How can we relate to anybody as a human being if there's just a body and mind there? So I ask you, tell me what more is there besides the body and mind. Those of you who gasped, think everybody did, everybody felt uncomfortable. So what more is there besides the body and mind? You feel like there's a person there, don't you? Yeah, there's a person who's special, who has their own personality, who has their own role in the universe, who has their own relationship to you, unless you're that person, in which case, you know, you're inherently existent, you're special, you're unique, you're this personality, and you relate to the rest of the world, but you're self-enclosed. You're self-enclosed, but you still depend on everybody else for food. And everything about you is changing, but you aren't really changing. Your body and mind is changing, but you aren't changing. Because I am I. And I exist here. I'm something in addition to the body and mind. But kind of mixed up with it too. Isn't that how it feels? You know? And there's really a me. And when I look at everybody else, there's a real them too. And I'm going to liberate I am going to liberate all these sentient beings who are so uniquely special, who are all going to love me because I'm going to be a compassionate bodhisattva. So finally, they'll all love me. Yeah, and I'll feel secure. And then I will give my body, give everything to sentient beings. And they'll write about me in the newspaper how generous I am. And even if they don't, I'll know how special I am as the world's foremost compassionate bodhisattva. Right? Because I'm special. I'm special. There's a real me in there that is special. And even when I die, that special me doesn't really change. It kind of, I don't know how it happens, but it's somehow, it's not form, it's not mine, but it's something, and it goes on into the next life. So that's really me. And then everybody that I'm attached to, that I love very much now, they're going to also go on to their next life and be really them. Okay, they'll look in a different body, but they'll still be the same person. They'll still be, have that special relationship and that same personality. Just as I will have my same personality. And I'll speak English in my next life too. You know? There's no talk about changing, you know, because your whole conceptual framework changes when you speak another language. But I'm going to speak English in my next life. My whole conceptual framework is exactly the same. That's the way we feel, isn't it? Okay, so that's all baloney. That's all baloney. Do you see how we grasp at there's got to be a real person? And how that attachment to self arises? That somehow that real person is special. At least I'm special to a few other people, and they're special to me, and that makes everything okay. Because if I wasn't special to anybody else, then who would I be? I would be a waif, unloved, in this heartless world where I was not special to anybody and everybody ignored me. Yeah? That's how we feel, isn't it? As if, yes, we're dependent. We're dependent on all other sentient beings for staying alive. But somehow, I'm going to be a waif and nobody's going to be kind to me because I'm not special to anybody. And they're not special to me. So why should they notice me? I have to be special. Do you see how our grasping and our attachment work? Yeah? And how we know all the words about, yes, dependent arising, emptiness, inherent existence. But our feeling inside and how we relate to other people, yeah, hasn't changed. Hasn't changed. Okay? So, and then when we hear even the teachings about it, we get nervous. Yeah? Wait, I need to belong to a family. If I don't belong to a family, I don't know who I am. I was thinking about that in terms of our cats. You know, they all have mothers and fathers. And they all, you know, with their litter, they were with their mothers and their siblings. And now I don't think they think about their mothers and fathers very much. Yeah? They're grown-up kitties themselves. But we have such an identity, you know, in our family. I often wonder if the cats, you know, were to encounter their mother and father, if they would remember them or recognize them after many years. Yeah? They would smell them and, you know, oh yeah, I remember that smell. Or not, if... Yeah. So quite interesting how we add on so much, don't we? So the idea is, you know, if we're able, you know, because we've been talking about equanimity the last few weeks, you know, getting, being free of attachment to friends, aversion to enemies, and apathy towards everybody else. And as long as we continue to see people special, either especially good or especially rotten, equanimity is going to evade us. So we have to see, you know, I think if we have some idea of emptiness, you know, equanimity becomes easier because we realize that all these appearances of people that appear to us right now are just karmic bubbles. They're just dependent, arising, changing things that have no essence. And you go, what? No essence? I have an essence, and those people out there have an essence too. Let's go back to talking about emptiness. Talking about emptiness, yes. Applying emptiness, no. So that doesn't mean that each continuity of consciousness is exactly the same. They're different, but they're the same in that they have 84,000 afflictions, just like us. Yeah, they're the same in that they have the Buddha nature, both the natural Buddha nature and the evolving Buddha nature. Yeah. But there's no special essence in them, just as there's no special essence in us. And because there's no special essence, that means that we can change. If there were a special essence that didn't exist dependent on any other factors, then it would be permanent, it would be unchanging. Something that doesn't depend on any other factors cannot change. It's fixed, it's static, which would mean that there's no way for us to become awakened, because we would be fixed, static, special people, yeah, who actually couldn't do anything, because anything we do involves change to ourself. Doesn't it? Anything we do means that we change. Okay, so because we're empty, the change is possible, meaning enlightenment is possible. Yeah. But we have to be willing to embrace that that dependent arising, which means there is no inherent essence. Okay, so from the point of view of sentient beings being empty of inherent existence, we're all alike. Nobody's special. It's not that one person has a prettier emptiness than another person. Or one person's emptiness is more highly educated and has a higher social status. Yeah. This was, you know, the Brahminical idea of the self, of the person, you know. There was a real self. And, you know, your value of as a person depended on that soul, on that self, that Atman that you had, because that determined what caste, if any, you were in. And your caste was, you know, are you a pure, you know, degrees of purity? So, you know, gets pretty mucked up that way. Okay, so equanimity. So with equanimity as a foundation, then we go into the 7-point cause and effect system to instruction to develop bodhicitta. So there's 6 causes and 1 effect. The causes are seeing sentient beings as our mother, remembering their kindness, wanting to repay their kindness, heartwarming love or affectionate love, compassion, the great resolve. Those are the 6 causes. And then bodhicitta is the 7th, the effect. Okay. So the first one, seeing sentient beings as our mother, this gets into the whole thing of rebirth. Yeah, we have to establish rebirth in order to think that we've had multiple lifetimes and so have other living beings, and that our relationships with other living beings have fluctuated such that, you know, they've all been our parents at one time or another. So I'm not going to get into a big talk about rebirth right now, but rebirth is something that can be proven through reasoning. It's not an extremely hidden phenomena that has to be accepted by faith. Yeah, it's a slightly obscure phenomena that can be proven by reasoning. What reasoning do you use? The reasoning of cause and effect. That anything that is a functioning thing that produces an effect was itself produced by causes. And that something that is produced by causes is impermanent. Its causes must also be impermanent. And the causes for the whatever we're talking about cannot be permanent. They cannot be some external creator. They have to be concordant causes that have the potential to produce the result. So, if you talk about sentient beings' mind streams, for example, okay, then the mind stream is clarity and cognizance. It is not something that is formed by nature. Yet it exists. Because we know phenomena, we experience, we feel, there is some experiential, cognizant factor in us that is called mind. And then what caused that mind? Well, each moment of mind now is caused by the previous moment of mind, back to the time we were born. And you know, the baby who came out of the womb had a mind, not as intellectually developed as our present mind, but they had a mind. And that mind came from the mind of the fetus in the womb back to the time when the mind entered into the fertilized sperm and egg, fertilized egg. Okay? So then the question is, where did that moment of mind come from that entered into the fertilized egg that started this particular life? Yeah. If you say, well, it was created by a permanent creator, an absolute creator that never changes, that has logical fallacies, because something that is absolute, that doesn't depend on any factors, is permanent. Something that is permanent cannot change. Producing a mind stream involves change. So being produced by some external creator, yeah, doesn't work. And since each moment of mind is clarity and awareness, it makes sense, you know, and something formless, then its cause also must be formless and must have that same nature of clarity and awareness. And so then you get the preceding moment of consciousness prior to that moment that entered into the zygote. Zygote.
Tomato.
Zygote. Maybe it's zygote. Anyway, before the consciousness entered into that. So, you know, that would establish a previous life. Because what else are you going to say is the cause of that first moment of consciousness? If you say that our mind came from our parents' mind, then you would really have to say that our parents lost their mind when they had us.
Which may be true.
Yes. Yeah. But, you know, even with our parents' mind, you know, do you have half of your mother's mind and half of your father's mind? Yeah. It's interesting, in Judaism, there's some, in the Kabbalah tradition, there's some idea of rebirth. But it's more like there's different parts from many different mind streams or many different people that come together to make a new person. But in Buddhism, we say no, because there's just, you know, there's a continuity. And in that continuity, one moment of clarity and cognizance produces the next moment, you know, and the next moment and the next moment. It's not that this moment of clarity and cognizance produces two other streams of consciousness. It's not that it breaks in half, and, or, you know, you have three kids and then, you know, or it's something like that. No, it's like this continuity that goes. Okay? So when you think about it like that, then, you know, we can play with the idea that we've been many different people in previous lives. And that can actually help us, I think, understand some things about our lives, like why we have certain predilections that we do, certain tendencies that we do. Yeah. Because there were certain habits that we formed in previous lives. And, you know, a habit is just something that you do very often. So it arises easily in a future life.
Yeah. You just said that the mind, which is clarity and awareness, does not divide itself into, you know, duality things, right? So then that brought a qualm about emanation. So a bodhisattva at a certain level is able to emanate a number of bodies, and they all are doing different things, going to
yes, but there's one consciousness.
Sorry.
Those emanations don't have different consciousnesses. So if we play with the idea that we've had multiple lives, then, and play with the idea, even by looking at our actions now, our actions in this life haven't all been virtuous. Yeah, there have been some virtues, so we may have had, you know, upper reverse in the past, you know, and we, you know, we have habits of non-virtue, so chances are we also had lower reverse in the past, you know, not that the present is causing the past, I'm not saying that, I'm saying that, you know, if you have a bad temper in this lifetime, it could be that you had quite a bad temper in a previous lifetime as well. Or if you were exceptionally kind this lifetime, had a habit with that. And you can see that kids from very young show personalities. And every time I talk to parents, you know, they tell me that they, all their kids have a different personality from the time they're born. You know, you have one baby that's colicky, you know, can't sleep through the night, you know, is easily frightened. You have another baby who's very peaceful. Now, from the time they're born, there's different personalities and habits. So what can account for this? Yeah. Now, you could say genes. But I think it's kind of tough proving that genes produce consciousness. Yeah? That, you know, things in our brain, the chemical activities in our brain, you know, which are, may be related to genes or may not be, I don't know, in specific cases, those things may correlate with states of mind, but that they create states of mind, I think you're going to have a hard time proving that. Yeah, proving that something that is molecular, material by nature, creates something that is non-molecular and immaterial and cognizant by nature. Because chemicals and synapses don't cognize. They may aid in cognition, but they aren't the cognizing, the cognizer. Okay? So it can be interesting to you know, think that, oh, you know, there are no beginnings to my rebirth. It's just been one rebirth caused by a previous one, caused by a previous one, caused by a previous one, and that there's no beginning because you can't assert a beginning. As soon as you assert a beginning, then you're with the question of what caused the beginning. And if something caused the beginning, then the beginning wasn't the beginning. And if nothing caused the beginning, how did the beginning begin? Because anything that exists and then functions and changes into something else has to have a cause. Okay? So, you know, to think about this, beginningless lifetimes, that gets a little bit, it can make you pretty uncomfortable sometimes when you think, you know, beginningless lifetimes. I've been going up and down in samsara with no respite, no time off, nobody to complain to, nobody could to appeal to say it's not fair. No court to judge that, you know, I'm being subjected to something that is, I don't deserve. It's just cause and effect. So there we are with all these beginningless lifetimes, having been born in all six realms of beings. Sometimes, you know, as immaterial gods in deep states of meditation, meditative absorption, other times in hell realms in incredible pain, other times as human beings, or maybe as animals, or maybe as desire realm, celestial beings who have great sense pleasure, or maybe hungry ghosts. You know, we've gone up and down in samsara beginninglessly, depending on what karmic seeds ripen at the end of a lifetime that are nourished by craving and clinging and propel the next lifetime or project the next lifetime. Okay? And so, you know, when we've been born in all these different realms, some of the realms have parents, some don't. Okay? In the hungry ghost realm, hungry ghosts have parents. Okay? Animals have parents. Human beings have parents. Gods are spontaneously born. No parents. Okay? But many of those realms, you know, we've had parents. So have we always had the same parents in each lifetime? No, because the parents of one lifetime, you know, they have their own mind stream, their own, all these diverse karmic seeds that have been planted on their mind stream. So they get born in all these different realms too. Upper realms, lower realms, get born as this, as that, all sorts of different things. And our lives don't always coincide with each other. Because some rebirths, you can be in that rebirth for a very long time, and other rebirths in it for a very short time. Yeah. So we could be born universes apart. We can be, you know, have, you know, lifespans that vary by eons. Okay. So in these different lives, we've had different mind streams have, or different people have been our parents in those different lifetimes, at least as animals and humans and hungry ghosts. And when you think about it, yeah, then you start playing with the idea, wow, so all these other living beings could have at one point or another been my parents. Then your mind says, ah, but I would recognize them if they were. But here's an example just taking place in this lifetime. If you were separated from your parents when you were born, and 50 years later you saw old folks on the street begging, would you recognize them as your parents? No. And that's just this lifetime. We wouldn't recognize our parents. So, you know, in multiple lifetimes, when we're going up and down in samsara, and they're going up and down in samsara, yeah, very difficult to recognize each other. And, you know, since rebirth is beginningless, lots of time for everybody to, at one time or another, been our parents. Now, at one time or another, they've also murdered us. They've also been our lovers. They've been our children. They've been our employers. They've been the president. They've been in all sorts of different roles with us. And we've been in all sorts of different roles with them. Because all this is constantly changing. Why then do they pick out parents, and especially the mother? Because for many people, and in many cultures, the mother is regarded as the person who has been most kind to us. Yeah. Now, while this is not universally true in the case of every human being, you know, there is some kind of general thing about that. If for no other reason than our parents gave us this body. So even if they gave us up, you know, on day one and left us in the New York City subway in a basket, still they've been kind to us because they gave us this life. Yeah? And if we have trouble thinking about our parents as being kind, which many Westerners do, you know, ever since Freud, you know, Freud gave us the possibility to blame all of our problems on our parents, you know, because of what they did and what they didn't do, you know, and then subsequent psychologists also, you know, childhood, we've all been traumatized as children. My goodness, what kind of identity is it to grow up? I'm a traumatized being. Yeah? To think of yourself, to have that self-image. Yeah. Of course, you may not develop it until you're older and you've been told that you've been traumatized. Okay? But, you know, because the definition of traumatized, it's really a personal one, isn't it? Whether we call it trauma or not. I don't think it's so much for other people to tell us. It's for us, you know, how we describe our experiences. In any case, yeah, to really, if you have difficulty thinking of your parents as kind or your mother as kind, then think of whoever it was who took care of you when you were little. Maybe a grandmother or an aunt or an uncle or a sibling or a babysitter or somebody in an orphanage or a teacher. And you can't say, nobody took care of me when I was little. You can't say that because if nobody took care of us when we were little, we would not be alive now. Why? Because when we were little, we couldn't feed ourselves. We couldn't cover ourselves when we were cold. We couldn't roll over. We couldn't express what our needs were. If we got sick, we couldn't say, I'm sick, take me to the doctor, I need medicine. You know? If nobody whatsoever took care of us when we were little, we would have died. So just the fact that we're alive today means that other living beings took care of us. Yeah. And whoever it was, for many people it was their parents, for some other people it may have been somebody else, but whoever it was, they've been kind to us. Because without their taking care of us, you know, very easily we would have died. And I think we can all tell stories of things that we did when we were little where we almost killed ourselves. Yeah? Like sticking things into live electric sockets. One time at DFF, we did kind of a go-around, and one person was saying, you know, on Sunday morning when her parents were sleeping, they decided to pretend to make breakfast. So they made pieces of toast out of paper and put it in the toaster. And started a fire in the house. And how many times, you know, we could have been at the top of a stairs and almost fell down, but somebody grabbed us? Yeah. How many times as infants did we choke? And somebody picked us up? You know, I saw this with Lama Yeshe's incarnation. Yeah, when he was a baby. He was maybe 18 months, 2 years old. He was choking, and all the monks and nuns didn't know what to do. And his mother just walked by. She had several kids before. Picked him up by his feet, hung him upside down, whacked him on the back. Whatever he was choking on came up, put him down, and that was it. But the kindness of the mother who, you know, focuses on the baby and saves us when we've been choking on things. Yeah. Or maybe you were like me and you rode your tricycle into the back of a car that was parked in the driveway and got, you know, your head all bloody. Or, you know, anybody have stories to tell? What's your story?
I had older sisters older than me, and then we had a pool in the house. So there was in the roof, they wanted to put me down to the pool, but the pool was empty. So they wanted me to be very courageous and to pull down to the pool. So the nanny got them and didn't let them.
Yeah.
Otherwise. And then another time my parents were away one night, and we were jumping on the beds, having a party. And then I just fell in the corner of the bed, and my head opened completely. And then they just put some Durex here with my hair, so my parents wouldn't see that I was injured, so they wouldn't get, you know,
in like, trouble.
Yeah. And then when my parents arrived, my daddy always, like, kissed us goodnight and, you know, like this. So when he did this to me, his hand was covered with blood. Mm-hmm. So I went to the hospital to give me stitches.
Yeah. Anybody else? Yeah.
There was a really tall, that tall, but a retaining wall next to the driveway, and I was walking the dog when I was really little, and I wrapped a leash around my hand, and we were up on that wall, and the dog jumped down, and I was dragged down.
And somebody came and rescued you. Anyone else? Oh, come on. So, yeah. So we see, you know, we all have stories, whether we're willing to tell them or not. Yeah. Like when we went miniature golfing, and my younger brother, you know, he had seen the golfers on TV, went like this, and of course I was standing behind him.
Oh, no.
Clung right in my head. So, yeah. Or the time my brother, he rode his tricycle into the deep end of the swimming pool and held on. And thank goodness the guy who cleans the pool was there, and he jumped in and pried him off with the tricycle. But, you know, we look, there's so many things. I mean, not just dangerous things like that, but just even having food every day when we were little. Yeah, due to the kindness of others, you know. And we got sick when we were little and people took care of us. Yeah. So really, you know, thinking, you know, that all sentient beings have been our mothers or our parents or caregiver, whoever it is, and that they've all been kind, and really thinking in specifics about the kindness of our parents. And even when we have, you know, at the beginning, if you have trouble with your parents, think of someone else whose kindness readily comes to mind. That's good. After a while, yeah, even if you have problems with your parents, it's good to go back and think of their kindness too, because so often we focus on the negativities, on what didn't happen that we wanted, or what did happen that we didn't want. And we just take for granted everything that they did do for us. Yeah. So, for example, when you think that we have the ability to speak, yeah, to speak, to understand language, you know, having that ability is amazing. I mean, what kind of living being would we be if we didn't have language to communicate with each other with? You know, we'd still be, you know, we wouldn't be human beings, would we? Yeah, language makes a huge difference. But who taught us to speak? Did we come out of the womb, you know, big smarty pants, knowing how to speak? No. We came out of the womb. Yeah. And for, you know, years, woke our parents up in the middle of the night. And they got up and fed us happily, even though they were sleep deprived. And then when we were capable of learning language, they would sit there and say words and have, so that we could copy the words. You know? Have you watched parents with their infants, with their toddlers? You hold the child in front of you, and then you make the word, and the child sees your lips and hears the sounds, and then the child can start to mimic it. Yeah? So parents go, goo, goo, ga, ga, and the baby goes, goo, goo, ga, ga. Yeah? It was hilarious. There was a thing about a Trump rally, a little video clip, where some parent gave their toddler to Trump to hold. And the toddler was just learning to speak. So whatever the last word was that Trump said, the baby said. Yeah? So, you know, Trump said, "What's your name?" And the baby said, "Name." And Trump said, you know, asked him different questions, and the baby would do that. And then he said, "Do you want to go back to Daddy or stay with Trump?" And the baby says, "Trump." Because it was just repeating the last word that he said. Yeah. At which point, Trump gave the baby back to Daddy. Okay, but to think, you know, what our parents went through teaching us how to speak. And then teaching us, you know, reading and writing. Our teachers may have taught us, but I'm sure our parents, you know, helped us to practice making the letters, you know, and gave us blocks with different letters and had us name the letters. You know, or numbers, how to count. Who taught us how to count? You know, we didn't know how to count when we were little. Somebody taught us. Yeah. Everything we know is because somebody taught us. And a lot of those elementary skills that we got as children, as infants, that enabled us to grow up to be productive adults, were taught to us by our parents or the caregivers. How to count, how to add, how to tie our shoes. Who potty trained us? Yeah, that's really the kindness of our parents, isn't it? If we hadn't been potty trained, boy, we'd have some problems now, wouldn't we? Okay, so have you, any of you ever been involved in potty training a child? I know you have. It's not easy to potty train a child. It's not easy. And yet they potty trained us, thank goodness. Okay. And then when we went to school, they made sure we go to school, even though sometimes we didn't want to. Yeah, I can't remember. If it was first grade or second grade. One of those. But, you know, I thought school was kind of boring, and I didn't want to go. So I had an upset tummy many mornings until I heard the school bus go around the corner, says my mother. And as soon as the school bus went around the corner, I felt well enough to get up and watch TV. But, you know, our parents kept us going to school. Yeah, helped us do our homework, or made us do our homework. Yeah, when we were obnoxious, they tried to teach us manners. Like, don't throw sand in other people's faces. Yeah, I mean, basic things that we needed to learn, to how to be a human being who can function in society. Yeah. Of course, some people learn manners better than others. Some people still have a problem with them. But, you know, we learn because, whatever we learn, because they taught us. Yeah. They taught us how to respond to different situations, how to express ourselves. Yeah. If we had athletic abilities, whoever took care of us, encouraged those. I was a failure. If we had artistic abilities or music abilities, they encouraged those. You know, when you look back as kids, we received so much that enabled us to become the adults that we are today. And so we have to look back at whoever took care of us then and see them as kind. Yeah? But not see them as kind in the sense that we then get attached to them. So this is not a meditation where you think about the kindness of your parents and then at the end you miss them and want to be with them and, you know, want to call home and everything like that. No, the purpose of this is you've seen that all sentient beings have been your parents. And thus, they've all been kind to you in the same way as the present life parents have been kind. So the memory of the present life parents or caregivers is more vivid in our minds. We don't remember previous lives. So we think about that, but we immediately have to generalize it to all other living beings that they've also been that kind to us in previous lives. Okay? And so here it's very helpful to really spend some time thinking about what our, you know, caregivers and parents and even teachers did for us. You know, waking up in the middle of the night, feeding us, changing our diapers. If you ever talk to parents, yeah, they don't consider their kids poo and pee dirty. Yeah, I've talked to parents about that, you know. Their baby is so precious that even the pee and poo that comes out is not like regular pee and poo. Yeah. It's precious pee and poo, even though you throw it out. Okay? Yeah. So, you know, they brought us up. They taught us to speak. They taught us manners. When we were little and we got sick, yeah, some of us may have had chronic health problems when we were little, or maybe we may have gotten injured when we were little, and somebody took care of us, yeah, and made sure we recovered because we're alive now. Yeah, And then all of our knowledge, again, we're not geniuses. We didn't come out of the womb knowing everything. Everything we know was taught to us by somebody else. Yeah? And so to really, you know, think, especially the kindness of the people who took care of us when we were little. Yeah? And then remember, every single sentient being has been in that role with us before. Yeah? So it doesn't matter what they look like now, but they've been in that role with us before. And even when we haven't been human beings, even when we've been born as animals or pretas, hungry ghosts, we had parents who took care of us. There's a dog at Copan when I first went. Her name was Sasha. And Sasha, I don't know if her back legs got hurt by a car or what happened, but she could only drag herself with her front two paws. Her back legs couldn't move. And she would drag herself all around the monastery looking for food, and, you know, they gave her scraps here and there. And then Sasha had a litter of puppies. You know, this poor dog, I can't imagine, you know, being lame and then having puppies, you know, sucking at her, jumping on top of her, whatever, and having to, you know, go and scrounge even more food than usual to feed these puppies. But Sasha loved her puppies, you know. When she gave birth, she licked her puppies and she cleaned them and she made sure that they got some milk. You know, just this automatic loving kindness. And I remember at Cloud Mountain watching when they had peacocks, you know, one of the peahens sat on her eggs, you know, day after day after day, and then finally the eggs hatched. And little baby peacocks, you know. And how Mama Peacock, you know, Mama Peahen, I should say, took care of her chicks, you know. They would, you know, Johnny would run this way and Susie Chick would run that way. And, you know, Martin Chick would go this way and, you know, yeah, Barbara Chick would go the other way. And, you know, Mommy Peahen had to get all of her chicks together and then sit on them. You know, that's how she kept them warm and how she kept them safe. So that dogs or coyotes or, you know, vultures or whatever didn't eat them. You know? And so you look in the animal realm, just this natural kindness that mothers have for their young. And then to think, you know, wow, I've been born a peacock and somebody took care of me like that. Or I've been born a puppy and they took care of me like that. Or whatever, you know, all these different things that we could have been born on, and but born as in previous lives. And then, you know, someone else, you know, usually the parents or the family, you know, took care of us and brought us up. Yeah? Elephants. Yeah. I mean, elephants, how long is an elephant pregnant for? Is it like 2.5 years? Something like that. Can you imagine being pregnant for 2.5 years? Yeah? And then out comes, how much does a baby elephant weigh? Maybe 100 pounds? Or more than 100 pounds? And you give birth to this 100-pound thing. Kerplunk. You know? And then the whole herd takes care of the baby elephant. Yeah? They're socialized by everybody in the herd. And especially all the mama, you know, all the women, because they're matrilineal, you know, take care of all babies in the elephant herd, just spontaneously, out of their own, you know, care and affection for living beings that can't take care of themselves. Yeah? So really spend some time thinking about that. Yeah? Again and again and again, all the different kindnesses. And then everybody's shown me that kind of kindness, even though I don't recognize them now. Okay? Even Bashar Assad, even, you know, showed us that kind of kindness in a previous life. Yeah? Even, you know, whoever it is who you don't like, yeah, showed you that kind of kindness. Or even somebody that you look at now, who are they? You know, they've showed us that kind of kindness in a previous life. Yeah. And so to kind of let that sink in, to let that sink in, the kindness we've received. And as we do, then automatically the third of the seven steps comes, which is wanting to repay that kindness. Because when we see the kindness as others have shown us, it doesn't take much to want to reciprocate. That's kind of natural in us in some way. When somebody's been kind, we want to reciprocate. Okay, so let's pause here and see if there's questions or comments. Yeah?
You said all sentient beings have been our mothers, or all living beings?
All sentient beings have been our mothers many times.
Sentient beings only. So it could be a fly, could be a mosquito, could be a rat, whatever.
Yeah. Because all the beings who are flies and mosquitoes and rats haven't always been flies and mosquitoes and rats. They may have been our parents when we were human beings. And we haven't always been a human being. We may have been born in an animal realm or whatever, and they were our parents then.
And the plants, like the nature,
yeah,
they're not sentient?
No.
We wouldn't have been like a tree or
no,
a mountain?
No. A sentient being can live in a tree as if the tree were their house or their habitat. Yeah. But the sentient being would not be a tree. Or the tree would not be the body of a sentient being. Mm-hmm.
For many years, I could not really see the kindness of my mother because I was angry at her and I didn't understand a lot of her choices. But when I became a mother myself, I understood her choice very clearly.
Yeah.
And I realized that that was in fact kindness.
Yeah. 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 So, not seeing the kindness of your mother when you were little, but once you became a mother, seeing what she had to endure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And how trying it can be to raise a child. And how parents lose it sometimes. Yeah? But I think when you've been a child and you're at the end of your, I mean, when you've been a parent and you're at the end of your rope, then you can understand how maybe your own parents were limited beings and got to the end of their rope and exploded.
What helped me a lot to forgive and let go of all that stuff is looking at my own stuff.
Uh-huh.
If I had kids, do you think I would be a perfect mom? Not at all.
Yeah.
No. I have my own afflictions, just like mom and dad have their affliction, and they did their best of what they knew, like how much mistake I have done and I'm still doing.
Yeah. So for you, like seeing the kindness of your parents and accepting their choices or whatever they did came from seeing, you know, that you're an afflicted being too. And then, yeah, mom and dad were afflicted. They did their best given, you know, their how they were brought up, given the circumstances that they grew up in and the circumstances they encountered in life.
I had only myself to take care of. They had five of them to take care of.
Yeah.
You know, to go to work and dress everybody and make sure they eat. And that's a lot of work.
Yeah.
So who am I to get mad at them?
Yeah. 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 When you see that, you know, what they did just to put food on the table for us. And how, I don't know about you, but I had no appreciation of that when I was a kid. No appreciation of what my parents went through to put food on the table. Yeah? But when you get older now and you look at it, you realize, wow, they had difficulties in their lives. And it wasn't easy being a parent. And then, especially, you know, if they had many kids. You know, if you have many kids, then there's more chance you're going to have kids who are, you know, who are naughty. Naughty, that's such a polite word. How about obnoxious? But now those kids are called, they have some kind of disorder. Defiant, obstinate disorder, something like that. Defiant oppositional disorder, yeah. Dodd. They're kids, but you know, they're kids with, yeah, and like how hard it is for parents. If you have a special needs kid, you know, who has a physical ailment or injury, or a child who, you know, is hyperactive or, you know, has strong anger or whatever, very difficult as a parent, you know. And then the more kids you have, the more chances, yeah, of having a kid like that. And, you know, when you just think of what our parents do by having a kid, you know, I mean, they trusted the universe when they had us. Yeah? Because when you have a kid, it is total potluck. You don't know what you're getting. Yeah? And every, you know, parents, when they have a baby, they love that baby. They may not be able to take care of the child so well because of their own afflictions or limitations, but they love that child. Yeah? And there we are, you know. Yeah, I want this, I want that, give me this, give me that. He started it, she started it, why do you always blame me? The neighbor has this, why can't I have it too? Why are you punishing me? I mean, what they go through to bring us up. And then when we become teenagers, oy vey, you know? And we're lying and we talk back. Yeah. And it's kind of amazing that they love us through all of this. You know? Even though sometimes they have to put us at arm's length because they can't endure us anymore. There's still the love. I remember I had one cousin. Now I think we understand that he has Asperger's. But at the time, you know, nobody knew what Asperger's was. And he was a very difficult child. Very, very difficult. And his mother stood by him through everything. You know? Everything he did. She was there. And the guys in prison that I write to, you know, Everybody else has walked out on them in their life, except their mother. You know, they're in prison, who knows what they've done, you know. The mother still is supporting them. And thus, of course, they killed their mother, which one guy I write to did.
So the way you are expressing this idea is due to equanimity. This is one of the seven causes for us to have equanimity towards sentient beings.
Mm-hmm. No, this is not a cause for equanimity. First we meditate on equanimity so that we have a more equal feeling towards everybody, a more equal, open, caring feeling. Okay? And then, in order to generate love and compassion, we have to see sentient beings as being kind. So the way to see them as being kind is to see that they've all been our parents or caregiver, then to remember all the kindness of the present parents or caregivers and generalize that to everybody else. That's the second step. And then the third step is then there's the wish to repay the kindness. Okay? And then from there we go on to heartwarming love and compassion and so on.
About 6 years ago, I went to the graveyard in Rocky Mountain House. I hadn't been there for decades. Mm-hmm. And so it really was striking to me that I knew, I would say, 80% of the people whose names are on the headstones. Huh. And I also knew that they had somehow impacted me or my family. You know, and just to see that kind of kindness and to remember those interactions. Mm-hmm. And in a town, you know, that's really possible. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the doctor would come and make house calls, you know, the public health nurse who would come and check on us, you know, and all these people that helped raise, you know, the kids in this town. And that was very striking.
Yeah. Yeah, so when you live in a small town, then you know everybody and you see how they all impact you. Yeah. Yeah.
Is there any other reason than natural reciprocation that we want to repay the kindness of others?
You mean other reasons why we should be kind to others? Is that the meaning of the question? Why else besides just natural reciprocation should we be kind to others?
Yeah, that we want to repay the kindness.
To repay the kindness. Because if you know what's good for yourself, you help others. Because if you don't help the people who help you, they're not going to help you in the future. Yeah, this is what our parents taught us too, isn't it? You know, and it's what Holiness says, if you want to be selfish, be wisely selfish and take care of others. You know, if you want to have a happy life, you have to take care of others. Yeah? So taking care of others doesn't mean we micromanage their life and we go around, you know, open wide, I'm going to feed you, zoom. You know, there's so many different ways to take care of others, so many different things to share with others. But, you know, we live in a world where we're dependent on others, and, yeah, we've got to contribute to that. Yeah?
Regarding what Venerable Yeshe was saying about understanding our parents in the way of understanding that they had things they were going through, mm-hmm. and it was difficult, and that, like them, we also have afflictions and stuff. That's something that we can apply to anybody in certain situations,
yeah.
as things come up. Sometimes it might not produce heartwarming love, but it can really help dissipate anger and such.
Yeah.
When we're having a hard time with someone. It can also be very educational for ourselves to see, like, oh, I have those afflictions too.
Yeah.
Yeah,
when we see someone else under the sway of an afflictions, than to think, you know, I've experienced that as well. I have that problem as well. Of course, that's always easier to do when they're manifesting their affliction towards someone else. When they're manifesting their affliction towards us, it's harder to do, isn't it? But still, if we can do it and say, wow, you know, I understand where they're at because I get like that too.
Even sometimes we can't do it in the moment, and we can do it a few moments later to let go of what we're holding on to.
Yeah, yeah. The more we can let go, the better it is for them too. Was there another question online?
Well, the person deleted it. The question was, why is it that some of us can remember? Why is it that we can't remember our past lives, but some people can?
Yeah, because we have bad memories. Well, you know, you study for a test, and the next day you can't remember what you studied. We can't remember from one day to the next, let alone one lifetime to the next. Although there, you know, are children who can remember. Yeah. You sent that article about the, it was Ian Stevenson's student?
Yeah.
Who was following up on that work. And yeah, and it's much more common for young children to have memories of previous lives. As you get older, you forget them. Yeah, but for young children to have memories and then the parents to follow up on those and see that, yeah, many times they're accurate. Okay, so maybe we'll stop here and then we'll get into heartwarming love next time. So, yeah?
Even though it doesn't produce so much of understanding of the kindness, sometimes I can feel close to some sort of a concern for someone by imagining you as a child rather than as a parent.
Yes.
Would that be Trump or Obama or my own weird neighbor?
Yeah, that it's often easier to develop tolerance and compassion for others if we think of them as a child than if we think of them as an adult. Because somehow we expect more of adults. Even though, you know, often the body is adult, but the mind is a child. Or maybe in some areas of life, the mind is an adult, and other areas, the mind is a child.
That also works well if you have difficulty with your parents to think of them as infant and then put it in the context of what their circumstance was and how it was for them.
I think that's very, very helpful to think about our parents as infants and the situations they were born into. What was going on in the country at that time, what was going on in their family, you know. So, you know, I know for me, it really helped me to understand my parents when I realized that they grew up in the Depression. Yeah, and they didn't have anything. And they were the children of immigrants. And, you know, and then all the family problems and everything else that went on in the families. And you think, wow, you know, my parents grew up in the middle of all that tumult. No wonder they're, yeah. No wonder that they have different problems and different things that really get to them.
Still cared for us. But still cared for us.
Yeah.
Despite all that.
Yeah, despite all of that, they still care for us. Or to think of what went on while they were bringing us up. I mean, I remember three times when I was little, my mom having to go into the hospital for surgery. And the last time it was for cancer. And despite all of that, you know, still bringing us up.
My parents were very different by the time they raised me than my sisters, who were 15 years or so older than me. And so they were, you know, they were raised in a way with, you got spanked with a belt when you were bad, you know. And then my older sisters were raising their own kids by the time I was 5 or so. And my mother was getting feedback and new ideas, and she was accepting them and raising us differently. You know, it's time out, you go to your room, you know.
Uh-huh.
And so, even though sometimes I think that accounts for some differences in how in children is, if you're a year younger than your sibling, you're raised by a different person. If it's, you know, we think of it as the same person, it's somebody who's already raised a kid or started, had a year's experience. You know,
right.
In this case, 15 years experience.
Right.
Parents are changing too and adopting new ideas.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Probably more tired.
Okay, go do it.
I think it's very helpful, you know, in that way to really consider our parents' lives and their experiences and develop some empathy and understanding for them. And to see how they change from kid to kid. Also because each kid is different, so they're going to act differently towards kids. And parents raise boys differently than they raise girls. Yeah. So boys, I think, have much more freedom. You're always taught, you can't do that, you might get hurt. It's too dangerous.
Especially at Shravasti Abbey in the West Floor.